burst out laughing, and Joseph and Renata pulled the two younger children away before they could be caught. They collapsed behind one of the lifeboats, panting and giggling. As Joseph dried his eyes, he realized he hadn't played like this, hadn't laughed like this, for many years. Joseph wished they could stay on board the St. Louis forever.
Isabel, just outside Havana, Cuba, 1994. The boat was heavy in Isabel's arms, and she was afraid of dropping it, even though there were five other people carrying it with her. She and Iván held the middle of the boat on either side, while Iván's parents and Isabel's father and grandfather carried the front and back. Señora Castillo, Iván's mother, was dark-skinned and curvy, and wore a white kerchief over her dreadlocks. Isabel's mother, almost 9 months pregnant, was the only one not helping to carry the boat. It was big and heavy to begin with, and they had packed it with the gas cans, plastic soda bottles filled with fresh water, condensed milk, cheese and bread, and medicine. Everything else had to be left behind. Nothing was more important than making it to Florida. It was night, and a waning moon peeked out from behind scattered clouds. A warm breeze lifted Isabel's short, curly hair and raised goosebumps on her arms. Fidel Castro had said that anyone who wanted to leave was welcome to go, but that was hours ago. What if he had changed his mind? What if there was a line of police waiting to arrest them at the beach? Isabel hefted the boat to get a better grip and tried to pick up her pace. They left the village's gravel road and hauled the boat over the dunes to the sea. All Isabel could see was the metal side of the boat in front of her face, but she heard a commotion behind her. There were people on the beach. Lots of them. She panicked, her worst fears come true, and suddenly a blinding light lit her up. Isabel cried out and let go of the boat. Ahead of her, Señora Castillo staggered and lost her grip too, and the front of the boat slammed into the sand. Isabel turned, holding a hand up in front of her eyes, and expecting to see a police searchlight shining on her. What she saw instead was a television camera. "You're on CNN," a woman said in Spanish, her face nothing but a silhouette against the light. "Can you tell us what made you decide to leave?"
"Quickly," Señor Castillo called from the other side of the boat. "Pick it back up. We're almost to the water."
"I..." Isabel said, frozen in the bright light of the camera. "Do you have any relatives back in Miami that you want to send a message to?" the reporter asked. "No, we..."
"Isabel, the boat!" Papi called.
The others had already lifted the boat up out of the sand and were lurching toward the sound of the crashing waves. The bright lights of the camera swung away from Isabel and lit up what looked like a party on the beach. More than half their village was on the sand, clapping, waving, and cheering on the boats. And there were so many boats. Isabel's family had worked in secret all night with the Castillos, worried someone might hear them, but apparently everybody else had been doing the same thing. There were inflatable rafts, canoes with homemade outriggers, rafts made of inner tubes tied together, boats built out of styrofoam and oil drums. A rickety-looking raft made out of wooden shipping pallets and inner tubes raised a bedsheet sail, and as it caught the wind, the villagers on the beach cheered. When another raft made out of an old refrigerator sank, everyone laughed. The camera lights swung around again, and that's when Isabel saw the police. There was a small group of them, up on the rocks overlooking the inlet. Not nearly as many as there had been in Havana, but enough. Enough to arrest her family for trying to leave Cuba. But these police weren't doing anything. They were just standing and watching. Castro's order to let people leave must have still been good.
"Chabela!" her mother called. "Chabela, come on!"
Mommy was already in the boat, and Papi was helping Iván in. Señor Castillo was trying to get the motor started. Isabel waded into the water,
the waves lapping up to the bottom of her shorts. She was almost to Poppy's outstretched arms when she saw her father's eyes go wide. Isabel looked back over her shoulder. Two of the policemen had broken from the group and were running toward the water. Toward them.
No! No! They're coming for me!
Poppy cried. Isabel fell into the water and swam the rest of the way to the boat, but her father was already climbing over the side.
Start the engine, he cried.
No, wait for me,
Isabel yelled, spitting seawater. She got a hand to the side of the boat and looked back. The two policemen had hit the surf and were running high-legged through the waves. Worse, the other policemen were running too, and they were all headed for the Castillos' boat. Hans grabbed Isabel and helped her climb the side of the boat. Ivan. But when he got her aboard, Ivan and his mother then reached their hands out for the two policemen who were chasing them. What were they doing?
No!
Poppy cried, scrambling as far away from them as he could. Ivan and Señora Castillo grabbed the arms of the two policemen and pulled them on board, and they all collapsed into the bottom of the boat. The policemen pulled off their berets, and Isabel recognized one of them instantly. One was Luis, the Castillos' elder son. The other policeman shook out his long black hair, and Isabel was startled to realize it wasn't a policeman at all. It was a policewoman. When she took Luis's hand, Isabel guessed she was his girlfriend. This must have been the Castillos' plan all along, for Luis and his girlfriend to run away with them. But they had never told Isabel and her family. Pack! A pistol rang out again over the waves, and the crowd on the beach cried out in panic. The pistol fired again, pack, and ping. The hull of the Castillos' boat rang as the bullet hit it. The police were shooting at them. But why? Didn't Castro say it was all right to leave? Isabel's eyes fell on Luis and his girlfriend, and she understood. They had been drafted into the police, and they weren't allowed to leave. They were deserters, and deserters were shot. The motor coughed to life, and the boat lurched into a wave, spraying Isabel with seawater. The villagers on the beach cheered for them, and Señor Castillo revved the engine, leaving the charging policemen in their wake. Isabel braced herself between two of the benches, trying to catch her breath. It took her a moment to process it, but this was really happening. They were leaving Cuba, her village, her home, everything she'd ever known, behind. Isabel's father pitched across the roiling boat and grabbed Señor Castillo by the shirt.
What are you playing at letting them on board? He demanded. What if they follow us? What if they send a navy boat after us? You've put us all in danger.
Señor Castillo batted Geraldo Fernandez's arms away.
We didn't ask you to come along.
It's our gasoline,
Isabel's father yelled. They kept arguing, but the engine and the slap of the boat against the waves drowned their words out for Isabel. She wasn't paying any attention anyway. All she could think about was the 90 miles they still had to go, and the water pouring in from the gunshot hole in the side of the boat.
Mahmoud, just outside Aleppo, Syria, 2015, one day from home. Mahmoud's father stopped their Mercedes station wagon for gasoline at a little roadside station north of Aleppo. Walid and Mahmoud sat in the car with their mother while she nursed Hana under a blanket. Fatima had put on a black long-sleeved dress and a pink flowery hijab that covered her head and shoulders. She and Yusuf had agreed she should cover up more than she usually did in Aleppo in case they ran into stricter Muslims outside the city. In some places, women were being stoned and killed for not covering up their entire bodies, especially in areas controlled by Daesh, what the rest of the world called ISIS. Daesh thought they were fighting the final war of the apocalypse, and anyone who didn't agree with their twisted perversion of Islam were infidels who should have their heads cut off. Mahmoud and his family planned to stay as far away from Daesh as possible, but the radical fighters were coming farther and farther into Syria every day. Mahmoud looked out the dusty car window as a jet fighter streaked by, high above them, headed for Aleppo. A mural painted on the side of the gas station showed President Assad, his dark hair cut short and a thin mustache underneath his pointy nose. He wore a suit and tie in front of a Syrian flag, doves of peace and yellow shining light surrounding him. A jagged line of real bullet holes bisected Assad's face. Mahmoud's father got back in the car. "I've got a route for us," Mom said. She finally had a signal and got Google Maps to open on her iPhone. Mahmoud leaned over to see. "This route crosses a country border," Google Maps told them, marking the alert with a little yellow triangle. That's what they wanted, to get out of Syria using the fastest path possible. Dad started the engine, put the car into gear, and they were off. An hour later, they were met on the road by four soldiers waving for them to stop. Mahmoud froze. The soldiers might be with the Syrian army or with the Syrian rebels. They could even be Daesh. It was hard to tell anymore. Some of these soldiers wore camouflage pants and shirts, but others wore Adidas jerseys and leather jackets and track pants. They all had short black beards like Mahmoud's father and wore headscarves of different colors and patterns. But each of them had an automatic rifle, which was really all that mattered. "Your hijab," Dad said, "quickly." Mahmoud's mother pulled the end of the scarf up over her face so that only her eyes were showing. Mahmoud sank to the floor of the old Mercedes station wagon and tried to disappear. In the seat beside him, Walid sat up straight next to his open window, unmoving and unfazed. "Everybody stay calm," Dad said, slowing the car down, "and let me do all the talking." One of the soldiers stood in front of the car, his rifle aimed loosely at the windshield, while the others walked around the sides, peering in through the windows. The soldiers were silent, and Mahmoud closed his eyes tight, waiting for the shots to come. Sweat ran down his back. "I'm just trying to get my family to safety," Dad told the men. One of the men stopped at the driver's side window and pointed his rifle at Mahmoud's father. "Which side do you support?" The question was as dangerous as his gun. The right answer, and they lived. The wrong answer, and they all died. But what was the right answer? Assad and the Syrian army? The rebels? Daesh? His dad hesitated, and Mahmoud held his breath. One of the soldiers cocked his rifle. Ch-check! It was Walid who spoke up. "We're against whoever is dropping the bombs on us," he said. The soldier laughed, and the other soldiers laughed with him. "We're against whoever is dropping the bombs too," the soldier at the window said, "which is usually that dog Assad." Mahmoud breathed again with relief. Walid didn't know it, but he'd saved the day. "Where are you going?" the soldier at the window asked. "North," Dad said, "through Azaz." The soldier opened the back door of the car and slid inside, pushing Walid into the back of the station wagon. "No, no, you can't go through Azaz anymore," the soldier said. "The Free Syria Army and Al-Qaeda are fighting there now." The door next to Mahmoud opened, and one of the soldiers nudged him up from the floor and into the back with Walid. Two more soldiers crammed themselves into the back seat, and the last one joined Mahmoud and Walid in the back with their backpacks. He was dusty and smelled like he hadn't had a bath in months, and the heat of the road radiated off him and his rifle like a stove. Apparently, they were all coming along for the ride. One of the soldiers in the back seat snatched up Mom's iPhone and looked at the route.
"Use Apple Maps," another soldier said.
"No, you idiot. Google Maps is better," said his friend. "See here," he told Mahmoud's father. "You'll have to go over to Katma and then north through Castel Sindo. The rebels and the army and Daesh are all fighting here," he said, pointing to places on the map. "Many guns and artillery. And the Kurds hold all this territory here. Russian airstrikes have hit here and here in support of that Alawite pig, Assad. And American drones are attacking Daesh here and here.
Mahmoud's eyes went wide. Everything the soldier was describing stood between them and Turkey.
Go back south, one of the soldiers told Mahmoud's father. You can let us off at Highway 214.
Dad turned the car around and drove. The soldier with the iPhone scrolled up the map to see their destination.
You're going to Turkey?
I went to engineering school there, Mahmoud's father said.
You shouldn't be leaving Syria, said one of the soldiers. You should stand up for your country. Fight the tyrant Assad.
Between Assad and Daesh, and Russia and America, Mahmoud thought, there wasn't much of a Syria left to fight for.
I just want to keep my family safe, Dad said. My family was killed in an airstrike, one of the soldiers said. Maybe when yours is too, you'll take up arms. But by then, it will be too late.
Mahmoud remembered the horror he'd felt when his apartment building collapsed, and he thought his mom was still inside. The fear he'd felt when they couldn't reach his father. If his parents had died in the airstrike, would he want revenge on their killers? Instead of running away, should Mahmoud and his father join the rebels and fight to win their country back? Mahmoud's dad kept driving. They were almost to the highway when gunfire erupted nearby.
Tat! Tat-tat-tat-tat! Tat-tat-tat!
And bullets pinged into the car. Mahmoud screamed and dropped to the floor as broken glass sprayed him. One of the back tires exploded, and the car swerved wildly and screeched as his dad fought to keep control of it. Mahmoud and Walid went tumbling, and the soldier in the back rolled on top of them. The soldier had a hole in his head. Mahmoud screamed again and pushed the man away as the car skidded to a stop. Bullets whizzed by, then caught the car again. Ping, ping, ping! And Mahmoud's dad threw open the driver's side door and pulled Mom and Hannah out with him.
Get out of the car, he cried.
The soldiers in the back seat kicked open the door on the left side of the car and spilled outside. More bullets whizzed by overhead, and soon the rebel soldiers who had been riding with them were returning fire, their automatic rifles booming in Mahmoud's ears like he was in a barrel, and they were beating on the outside of it with hammers. All Mahmoud wanted to do was curl up into a ball and disappear. But he knew if he and Walid stayed in the car, they would end up like the dead soldier beside them. He had to get up, get out, move. His heart was pounding so hard he thought it would burst right out of his chest. But Mahmoud found the courage to grab Walid by the arm, drag him over the seat, and dive headfirst out the door. They tumbled into the ditch beside his parents. Hannah was wailing, but Mahmoud almost couldn't hear her over the sound of the gunfire. Mahmoud's dad waited for a pause in the gunfire, then scrambled back up the ridge for the car.
Yusuf, no! Mom cried. What are you doing?
Mahmoud's father dove back into the front seat and yanked the iPhone and the charger cord from the Mercedes just as bullets ripped into the car again. He tumbled and slid back down into the ditch.
Had to go back for the phone, he told them. How else am I going to play Angry Birds?
He was joking again. Mahmoud knew they needed their phones to help them get to Turkey. Without the maps, they'd be lost. Mahmoud's father waited for another lull in the shooting, and then they all hurried away from the car, leaving everything else they owned behind.
Joseph. Somewhere on the Atlantic Ocean, 1939. 8 days from home. Finally, Shabbos arrived. It was the day Joseph would leave his childhood behind and become a man, and he could hardly contain his excitement. The ship's bulletin board announced that the first-class social hall would be converted to a synagogue, a Jewish house of prayer, which meant Joseph might have his bar mitzvah after all. He was careful not to show his eagerness in front of his father, however. What would once have been a happy occasion in the Landau home was now fraught with anxiety, thanks to his father's paranoia. A synagogue? On board the ship? Papa said. He shook his head as he paced their little room in his oversized night clothes. The captain himself has arranged it, Mama said. Ridiculous! Did no one else see the Nazi flag overhead as we came on board? Will you not go to your own son's bar mitzvah, then?